Hag paddles all the way to the Great Harbor Yacht Club. Then he turns around and heads for home. He wills himself to be strong enough for what awaits him there. He has never quite mastered the art of getting out of the kayak and nearly always dunks himself in the process. This gives Greer much joy and himself a much-needed cooling off, so he is half guilty of facilitating the mishap. After he pulls the kayak up on the shore, he towels himself dry and checks his phone. There's a voicemail from his friend Sergio Ramon. Tag finds Greer arranging flowers on the sun porch.
Sergio called, he says. He has two tickets to the Dujac Grand Cru wine festival dinner tonight. The chef from Nautilus is doing the food, and it's at some swanky house out on Quay's Pasture Road. I told him we'd take them. They're ridiculously expensive, but we deserve it.
I can't go, Greer says.
What? Tag says. Why not? You love Dujac. It's blue-chip terroir. Not Sonoma, not South Africa. These wines will be once in a lifetime. You know how these French vintners are. If you show the proper appreciation, they can't help themselves. They open up the bottles they aren't supposed to. The really, really good stuff. The rare vintages that we'll never have the opportunity to taste again.
I have to stay home and write tonight, Greer says. My deadline is in 30 days, and I'm dreadfully behind because of the wedding. Also, I had an idea while Celeste and I were out, and I want to get it down before I forget.
The dinner isn't until 7, he says. Go right now, and you'll be finished by 6. In time for a shower and a dressing drink.
I can't now, Greer says. I'm busy.
I'll arrange the flowers, Tag says. You go right.
You know it doesn't work like that, darling, she says.
He wants to strangle her. He should never have expected his wife to suddenly display a penchant for spontaneity. He knows it doesn't work like that. He knows Greer can't be prodded to write, that she has to listen to her internal muse, and the muse prefers the nighttime hours, a quiet, dark house, a glass of wine, ordinary wine, a $15 bottle of Chardonnay, for example, which will have nothing in common with the wine that will be served with this dinner.
What the hell am I going to do?
Tag says. I promised Sergio I'd take the tickets off his hands. If it were anyone else, Tag would call and renege, but Sergio is an esteemed criminal defense attorney, and he's also the friend who got Thomas into law school at NYU when there was no prayer of Thomas getting in on his own. And then Sergio angled to get Thomas a job at Skadden Arps, the law firm where Thomas now works. Thomas, Tag has to admit, isn't the achiever the rest of them are. Tag suspects he'll quit law before he makes partner. But even so, Tag and Greer owe Sergio Ramon a lifelong debt of gratitude. Tag can't back out on these tickets. He can pay the $3,500 apiece and just not go, he supposes. But what a waste that would be. Please, darling. Greer stabs a peony into the vase. The peony is deep pink and resembles a human heart unfurling in desperation. Or possibly he's projecting. Take one of the girls, she says. Tag scoffs.
I'm serious, Greer says. Don't be a martyr for me. I won't like that one bit. Ask one of the girls.
But isn't this supposed to be a bachelorette weekend? Tag says.
They partied last night, Greer says. Unless I'm mistaken, they're planning on staying home tonight. But I'm sure you can talk one of them into it.
The girls, as Greer calls them, are in the casual dining area, reading magazines, snacking on chips and salsa. Merritt, as in the parkway, Tag is relieved to see, has covered herself properly, in white jeans and a navy cashmere sweater. Abby is resting her head on her arms on the table.
Hello, ladies, Tag says.
His stomach feels leaden. It's nerves. He knows how this is going to end. Greer, too, must know how this is going to end. She is the one he will hold responsible. She has suspected him of cheating for the entirety of their marriage, he knows. And now it feels like she is pushing him toward it.
I have an extra ticket to a very fancy wine dinner tonight, and my wife feels she needs to stay home and write. Would any of you three like to go with me?
God, no, Abby groans.
No, thank you, Celeste says sweetly. I'm exhausted.
Merritt raises her face and looks him dead in the eye. His heart skips a beat. Tag wears a jacket but no tie. Merritt wears a lavender dress with thin straps that crisscross her back and a pair of silver stiletto heels. It's the heels Greer chooses to comment on.
You'll break your neck in those, she says.
I'll be fine, Merritt says. Years of practice.
Well, Greer says in Tag's ear as she kisses him goodbye, I believe Quay's pasture is in for quite a shock.
Once they're in the Land Rover headed out the Pulpus Road, Tag worries that Merritt will reach over and put her hand on his leg. Then he worries she won't. He has an erection simply from smelling her perfume and listening to her rummage through her clutch purse in the dark. He can't go inside in this state. He needs to talk himself down. He takes a deep breath. He worries there will be someone he knows at this dinner. And how will he explain who Merritt is?
My future daughter-in-law's best friend.
It sounds sleazy. It is sleazy. What will people think?
They'll think
the obvious. But then Tag calls upon one of his favorite sayings, perception is reality. This situation can be translated in more than one way. Tonight, Tag will perceive this outing as innocent and fun, and that is what it will become. He relaxes a little.
Is this your first time on Nantucket? He asks.
Not at all, she says. I've come with friends over the years, in college and then as a so-called adult.
Where was college? He asks.
Trinity, she says. In glamorous Hartford.
He has friends whose children went to Trinity, but he doesn't dare ask if Merritt knows any of them. He's already self-conscious enough about how young she is, or how old he is.
Do you have siblings? Tag asks.
A brother, she says. Married with kids and a mortgage.
And where did you grow up? Tag asks.
On Long Island, she says. Commack.
Tag nods. He and Greer have successfully avoided Long Island, though he does have a client with a house in Oyster Bay whom he visits on occasion. And there was one long-ago rainy weekend in Montauk when the boys were small. He has never heard of Commack.
I always wanted a daughter, he says. But Greer didn't. She's happy with the boys.
Greer is lovely, Merritt says.
Isn't she? He says. Anyway, now we have a daughter-in-law, Abby. And soon Celeste.
Celeste is a treasure, Merritt says. I met her at a difficult time in my life. She saved me.
This statement seems to warrant a follow-up question, but it's too late. They've arrived. The house is, in fact, grand. It's all lit up from within, overlooking the Sound, but from a more dramatic vantage point than Tag's house. There are two unfamiliar cars in the driveway. Tag parks, then smiles at Merritt. This is going to be innocent and fun.
Shall we? He says.
The evening unfolds easily. There are 10 diners, plus the French gentleman from the esteemed Dujac Vineyard, plus one of the sous chefs from Nautilus, plus 2 kitchen staff and 2 wait staff. Tag doesn't know a soul. The other 8 diners are all one group. They tell Tag it's their first time to Nantucket. They live in Texas.
Where in Texas? Merritt asks.
Tag steels himself to hear that they're from Austin, and then to find out that they are best friends or business partners of Abby's parents, the Freemans.
San Antonio, they say. Remember the Alamo.
It quickly becomes obvious that Merritt knows nothing about wine, not even the basics. She doesn't know that Cabernet Sauvignons are from Bordeaux and that Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays are from Burgundy. She doesn't know what terroir is. She has never heard of Pinot Franc. She has never heard of the Loire Valley. How can she be an influencer of culture when she doesn't have even a basic vocabulary of wine? What does she drink when she goes out?
Cocktails, she says. Gin, bourbon, vodka, tequila. Skinny margaritas are my go-to.
She must see him grimace because she adds, There used to be a place downtown, Pearl and Ash, that made a cocktail called Teenage Jesus, which was my particular favorite. Plus, the name.
Tag can't imagine drinking something called a Teenage Jesus.
What about when you have oysters? When you have caviar? Surely you must drink champagne.
Prosecco, she says, but only if someone presses it on me. It gives me a headache.
After his starter glass, a 2013 Chambol Musigny, goes down, he decides that Merritt's ignorance is fortuitous. She isn't the jaded, worldly woman he thought she was. He had convinced himself over the past few hours that she was at least 30, but now he fears she's closer to 25, more than 30 years younger than he is. After his second glass, a 2009 Moret Saint-Denis, he is loose. He will teach Merritt about wine. He will teach her how to roll the wine over her tongue. He will teach her how to identify black cherry and tobacco notes in Pinots, and lemon, mint, and clover in Sauvignon Blancs. He's excited by this mission, although her palate will be exposed to some of the finest wines in the world tonight, and this worries him. When you start with the best, the future offers only disappointment. They stumble out of the house well past midnight, hand in hand. At one extremely saturated point during the evening, one of the Texas ladies turned to Merritt and said,
So how long have y'all been married?
Without hesitation, Merritt said, We're newlyweds.
Congratulations, the woman said. Second marriage?
Merritt winked. How'd you guess? So when they leave, they are a couple. Married by the incredible wine, the extraordinary food, the camaraderie of complete strangers. It's as if they have stepped out of their lives into another life where everything is new and anything is possible. When Tag opens the passenger door for Merritt, she turns to him and raises her face. He kisses her once, chastely on the lips.
That's all I get, she says.
Say yes, Tag thinks. Be strong. Be true to Greer and the boys. Show some integrity, for God's sake. But even that faintest touch of her lips sent a surge of electricity through him. Tag is pulsing with desire for her. He won't be able to stop himself from driving Merritt to the beach and making love to her, maybe more than once. He is, ultimately, only a man.
Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 8:30 a.m.
The Chief. After interviewing Roger, the Chief has some choices for who to talk to next. There's the bride's father, who is in an upstairs bedroom with the bride's mother. Greer Garrison has requested that they not be disturbed until the last possible minute because of the mother's health. And the groom, Benjamin Winbury, asked permission to go to the hospital to check on Celeste. He promised to be back in an hour. So, as far as persons of interest go, that leaves the chief with the groom's brother, Thomas, the groom's father, Thomas Sr., known as Tag, and this shooter fellow, the best man. The chief thinks the third option is the most promising. Dixon said the best man was missing when he arrived on the scene, but then the guy turned up in a cab an hour later. He could have met a woman, or a man, last night and slept elsewhere. But the perplexing thing is that he had his luggage with him. It's almost as if he'd planned to leave and then changed his mind. There might be a plausible explanation for this, but the chief can't come up with it himself. He will question Shooter. The chief finds Shooter standing behind the police tape at the edge of the beach, staring in the direction of the water. He has shed the blazer, removed his shoes, untucked his shirt.
"Hey there," the chief says.
Shooter turns. His expression is one of fear, maybe, or alarm. The chief is used to it. In 30 years, no one has been exactly happy to see him while he was on duty in the field.
"Are you free to answer a few questions?"
"What about?"
Shooter says.
"We're interviewing everyone who's part of the wedding. I understand you're the best man."
"If you're going to ask me what happened to her, I really have no idea," Shooter says.
"I'd just like to get some background," the chief says, "about the events of last night. Easy stuff."
Shooter nods.
"I can handle that, I suppose."
"Great," the chief says. He leads Shooter across the driveway to the white, wrought iron bench under the rose arbor where he talked to Roger. He sees police tape all around the cottage on the north side of the property, which was where the maid of honor was staying by herself. The chief is fairly certain that if they can find the girl's phone, they'll have the answers they're looking for. The chief has learned over the past decade that if you want to know the truth about a person, just look through his or her phone. Shooter takes a seat and the chief pulls his notebook out. He has only one question for Shooter.
"So, where were you last night?"
"Last night?" Shooter says.
Just like that, the chief knows a lie is coming.
"Yes, last night," the chief says. "The groom told my sergeant that you were missing. Until you pulled up in the cab, we thought maybe you were dead as well. But thankfully, we were mistaken. Where were you?"
"I'm sorry I caused you to worry," Shooter says. "I was up at the Walwinnet."
"The Walwinnet Inn?" the chief says.
"The restaurant, actually. Topper's? I'm friendly with the bartender there."
"And what's the bartender's name?"
"Name?" Shooter says. "Oh, Gina."
"The bartender at Topper's is named Gina. And you spent last night with Gina?"
"Yes," Shooter says.
"She lives up there?" the chief asks. "At the Walwinnet?"
"Yes," Shooter says. "Staff housing."
"Had you planned to spend the night with Gina?" the chief asks. "Because the groom seemed to think you'd spent the night in the cottage."
"I hadn't planned on it, no," Shooter says. "It was just a booty call. It was late. She texted. I went up there."
A booty call. The chief thinks protectively of Chloe. He feels 100 years old.
"What time was that?"
"I'm really not sure," Shooter says.
"You can check your phone," the chief says.
Shooter slips his phone out of the pocket of his Nantucket Reds shorts. He pushes some buttons and says,
"I must have deleted the text."
"You must have deleted the text," the chief says.
"Tell me why you took your luggage. All of your luggage, from the looks of it."
"Right," Shooter says. His tone is cautious, and the chief can practically see the shadowy interior of his mind where he's groping around for something solid to hold on to.
"I took my luggage because I thought I might just stay up at the Walwinnet with Gina.
But then this morning, quite early, I'd say, you showed back up here. So what happened?"
"I changed my mind," Shooter says.
"You changed your mind," the chief says.
He looks at Shooter Uxley. The kid is sweating, but then again it's hot, even in the shade.
"Would you mind giving me this Gina's cell phone number, please?"
"Her number?" Shooter says. "I'd rather not. I don't want her to get involved in this if we can help it."
"We can't help it," the chief says, "because Gina is your alibi."
"My alibi?" Shooter says. "Why do I need an alibi?"
"We have an unattended death," the chief says, "and you were missing. Then you showed back up. Now, maybe your story holds water. Maybe you did go up to the Walwinnet to hook up with Gina the bartender with all your luggage, and maybe you did then decide you didn't like Gina that much, or that the staff housing wasn't as nice as the Winbury's guest cottage. That's all feasible. But we have a 29-year-old woman dead. So I'm going to proceed with due diligence and check out your story. You can either give me the girl's cell phone, which I know you have because you said she texted you late last night, Or I'll call the front desk of the Walwinet and contact her that way.
Shooter gets to his feet.
Call the Walwinet, he says. I need to use the bathroom right now. My stomach is funny. I think it was the raw bar from last night.
Go ahead, the chief says.
He's not stupid. He knows that Shooter will go into the cottage to use the bathroom, but really he'll text Gina the bartender and ask her to corroborate his story. The chief waits until Shooter disappears into the cottage, then he takes out his phone and calls Bob from Old Salt Taxi. Bob, who dropped Shooter off here this morning, has been a friend of the chief's for 25 years.
Hey, Bob, the chief says. It's Ed Kapanash.
Ed, Bob says.
Sorry I didn't stop to chat this morning. You looked like you were busy. What's going on? Word on the street is there was a murder.
Word on the street. Already? Well, it is a small island.
I can't get into it, the chief says. But you remember the kid you dropped off? I need to know where you picked him up. Did you pick him up at the Walwinet?
The Walwinet? Bob says.
No. That real handsome kid in the red shorts and the blazer? I picked him up down at the steamship. He had a ticket for the 6:30 slow boat this morning, but I guess he missed it. And so he asked me to take him back to Monomoy. He said he was staying there.
You're sure you picked him up at the steamship dock? The chief says. And not at the Walwinet?
Sure I'm sure, Bob says. I may not be getting any younger, but I have yet to make a 12-mile mistake. I picked that kid up on Steamboat Wharf. He told me he'd missed the 6:30.
Okay, Bob, wonderful, thanks. I'll talk to you.
The chief hangs up and takes a second to think. Shooter had a ticket for the early boat? With the wedding scheduled for this afternoon? Something is going on. And he flat-out lied about the Walwinet. Why? A text comes in on the chief's phone. It's from the funeral director, Bostick, saying he's on his way to collect the body, which is good news considering the heat and the fragile state of everyone's nerves. Bostick will get the body ready for transfer to the medical examiner on Cape Cod. The chief checks the time. If everything goes perfectly, they may have a report on the cause of death by early afternoon. The chief waits another few minutes for Shooter to emerge. By now, he must know he's been caught in a lie. The chief strides across the shell driveway to the cottage that Shooter entered and knocks on the door.
Excuse me, he says. Mr. Uxley?
No answer. He knocks harder.
Sir?
The chief tries the knob. The door is locked. He forces the door, which feels extreme, but he wants Shooter Uxley to know he can't hide. The cottage is empty. The chief checks the little sitting room, the galley kitchen, the bedroom, and the bathroom, where the window is wide open. Shooter Uxley is gone.
Friday, July 6th, 2018, 4 o'clock p.m. Karen. She wakes up from her nap with the sun striping her bed, and for one glorious instant, she feels no pain. She sits up without any help. It's as if Nantucket Island, the quality of the air, the rarefied seaside atmosphere, has cured her. She's going to be fine.
Betty?
Karen turns. Celeste emerges from Karen's bathroom, wearing a ruffled sundress the color of a tangerine, a sunset, a monarch butterfly. It's bright and very flattering. Celeste may have the brain and temperament of a scientist, but she has the body of a bathing suit model. She inherited Karen's breasts, which used to be her best feature, round and firm. But along with the breasts, Celeste may also have inherited the predisposition to cancer. Karen has made Celeste promise that as soon as she and Benji are married and Celeste has comprehensive health insurance, she will go to Sloan Kettering for genetic testing. And if necessary, she will get screened every year. Early detection is key.
Hello, sweetheart, Karen says. What are you doing here? Surely you have more important places to be? This is your time to shine. I was putting your toiletries away, Celeste says. And now I can help you get ready.
Karen's eyes prick with tears. It is she who should be helping Celeste. She who should be fussing over her daughter, the bride. But there is no denying that if Karen is to get dressed and make herself presentable, she will need help.
Where's your father? She asks.
Swimming, Celeste says. There's a stabbing pain in Karen's chest. It's jealousy. Bruce is swimming. Karen yearns to be with him, to feel the power of her four limbs. She had once been so strong. She remembers swimming the butterfly leg on her relay team, soaring from the water, arms stretched overhead, legs pumping behind. When she looks back at her life, she sees how much she has taken for granted. Celeste is by her side. Karen takes a moment to look up at her face. Her eyes are sad, and Karen is concerned about the stutter, although she hasn't mentioned it because she doesn't want to make Celeste self-conscious for fear that the stutter will get worse. She knows that Benji and Celeste have whittled down their wedding vows so that all Celeste has to say is, I do.
Is everything okay? Karen asks.
Yes, but Betty, of course, Celeste says.
The nickname never fails to give Karen joy, even so many years later. She is Betty for Betty Crocker, because Karen swears by the tattered, spiral-bound cookbooks she inherited from her own mother. Bruce, meanwhile, is Mac for MacGyver, because he has a talent for unconventional problem-solving. The man can fix anything and prides himself on not having called a repairman in 30 years of marriage. Celeste gave them the nicknames when she was 11 years old and had outgrown Mommy and Daddy. Karen strokes Celeste's forearm and Celeste adjusts her smile so that it seems almost real. She's pretending. But why? Is she feeling scared and anxious about Karen's illness? The decline has been significant, Karen knows, even in the 2 weeks since she last saw Celeste. Karen had dropped 13 pounds as of a week ago, and maybe another 10 since then. Her stomach is compromised. She eats a bite or two of food per meal and forces down enough Ensure to keep up her strength. Her hair is nothing but gray fuzz, like one finds on a pussy willow. Her eyes are sunken and her limbs tremble. It has probably come as a shock to Celeste. But Karen isn't persuaded that she, Karen, is the reason for Celeste's pensive, faraway mood. It's something else. Maybe the stress and pressure of being the center of attention. This wedding is huge. The setting is grandiose. Elaborate, expensive plans have been made, with Celeste and Benji at their center. It would be intimidating for anyone. When Karen married Bruce, there were 6 people in attendance at the Easton Courthouse. She and Bruce celebrated afterward with a bottle of Asti Spumanti and a pizza from Nicolosi's. Or maybe the problem isn't the wedding. Maybe it's Benji himself. Karen thinks back on her ill-advised visit to Catherine Randall, the psychic. Chaos.
Darling, Karen says.
Celeste looks at her mother, and their eyes lock. Karen sees the truth in Celeste's clear blue irises. She doesn't want to marry Benji. Karen needs to reassure Celeste that she's doing the right thing. Benji is a good man. He adores Celeste. He keeps her on the exact same pedestal that Karen and Bruce placed her on at the moment of her birth. That's really the wonderful thing about Benji. He loves their daughter the way she deserves to be loved. That, and he has money. Karen would like to pretend that the money doesn't matter, but it does. For over 30 years, Karen and Bruce have lived from paycheck to paycheck. 95% of their decisions have had to do with money. Should they buy organic fruit so Celeste wouldn't be exposed to a lot of pesticides? Yes. Should they drive the extra 20 minutes to Phillipsburg, New Jersey for cheaper gas? Yes. Should they take Celeste to the orthodontist who allegedly had been accused of child molestation, but who charged half as much as the reputable orthodontist? No. They had enough money to pay their mortgage and send Celeste to college, but any financial surprise, a leak in the roof, a raise in property taxes, a cancer diagnosis, was enough to sink them. Karen doesn't want Celeste to have to live that way. She has a college degree and a good job at the zoo, but Benji can give her everything. And everything is what she deserves. As Karen opens her mouth to assure her daughter that she is doing the right thing, Bruce comes into the room with a navy and white striped beach towel wrapped around his waist. Karen feasts her eyes on her husband. To her, he's every bit as beautiful as he was on the pool balcony so many years ago. His shoulders are defined by rippling muscles. His chest is smooth and broad. They have never had money for gym memberships. Bruce does old-fashioned calisthenics, sit-ups, push-ups, and pull-ups, in their bedroom every morning before work. He has been outside for less than an hour, and already his skin has a healthy golden glow. Karen always envied the Mediterranean blood he'd inherited from his mother. He would go outside to mow the lawn and come back a bronzed god. "Both my girls," he says. "What a surprise!"
Did you get the reds, Mac?" Celeste asks. "For tomorrow?"
"Yes," Bruce says. He pulls a pair of pants out of the closet. They are the color of dusty bricks. "I don't see what the big deal is. It's certainly not the style. Is it the color? Mrs. Winbury, Greer, told me they would fade with every washing. It sounds like I'm going to need to spring for the dry cleaner."
No, you should wash them," Celeste says. "That's the idea. The more they fade, the cooler they are."
"That makes no sense," Bruce says. "Did you happen to notice the black jeans I had on earlier? Sleek as a panther."
"The reds are different, though," Celeste says. "It's a Nantucket thing, darling," Karen says to Bruce. She thinks she gets it. The older and more worn the pants, the more authentic they are.
The sleek as a panther look, shiny and new, doesn't work on Nantucket. The preferred aesthetic is a careless appearance. Faded pants, frayed collars, scuffed penny loafers. Bruce won't understand this, but Karen gives him a look that implores him to just get with the program. The last thing they want to do is make a fuss and embarrass Celeste. Bruce catches Karen's eye and seems to read her mind.
"I'll do as you tell me, bug."
He throws on a t-shirt, then takes Celeste's hand and Karen's hand so that they form a human chain. But every chain has a weak link, and in their case, it's Karen. She's leaving them behind. The agony of this is exquisite. There is nothing more terrible, she has decided, than the ferocity with which humans can love.
"I came in to help Betty get ready," Celeste says. "The party starts in a little while."
"What about the rehearsal?" Bruce says. "Aren't we all going to the church?"
"Reverend Derby's flight from New York was delayed, so we decided to scrap the rehearsal," Celeste says.
Karen is relieved. She isn't certain she would have made it through both the rehearsal and the party. Bruce, however, seems miffed.
"How are we supposed to practice our walk?" he says.
"We don't have to practice," Celeste says. "We link arms, we walk, slowly. You hand me off to Benji. You kiss me."
"I wanted to practice," Bruce says. "Practice doing it without crying. I figured since today was the first time I'd cry, but then tomorrow it would be old hat and maybe I wouldn't cry. Maybe. But I wanted to practice."
Celeste shrugs.
"We decided not to do it."
Bruce nods.
"All right. I'll help your mother. You go relax, bug. Have a glass of wine."
"Find Benji," Karen says. "The two of you could probably use some alone time before all this begins." "But I want to stay here," Celeste says. "With both of you."
Bruce helps Karen in and out of the shower. Celeste helps Karen put on a soft white waffle-knit cotton robe with a light terry cloth lining. There are two in every guest room, Celeste tells her, laundered after each use by Elita, the Winbury's summer housekeeper. And then Celeste rubs her mother's arms, back, and legs with Greer Garrison's favorite lotion, La Prairie White Caviar Illuminating and Moisturizing Cream, also in every guest room. The lotion is like none Karen has ever used before. It's rich, luscious even. Karen's skin drinks it in. Bruce helps Karen get dressed. She is wearing a silk kimono over black leggings and a pair of Tory Burch ballet flats from two seasons ago that Bruce plucked off the sale rack for pennies. Style, Bruce says, and comfort. Karen looks in the mirror. She's swimming in the kimono. She tugs on the belt.
Lipstick, Betty, Celeste says.
She dabs at Karen's lips with the nub of Karen's old standby, Maybelline's New York Red. It's the only lipstick Karen has ever worn, or ever will wear.
I'd say you're ready, Bruce says. You look stunning.
I just want to use the toilet real quick, Karen says.
This, at least, she can still do without help. She closes the door to the bathroom. She needs an oxycodone. Two, actually, because so much is expected of her. She'll be introduced to dozens of people she doesn't know and wouldn't care about, except that some of these people will remain in Celeste's life long after Karen is gone. And Karen is determined that every single one of those people will remember her, Celeste's mother, as a lovely woman. Karen can't find her oxy. The pill bottle was in her Vera Bradley cosmetic bag, along with her lipstick and a Revlon mascara that was rendered useless when she lost her eyelashes. Where? Karen tries not to panic, but those pills are the only thing keeping her going. Without them, she will curl up in bed in a fetal position and howl with pain. Karen's gaze sweeps the gleaming marble, glass, and mirrored surfaces of the guest bathroom. There's Karen's toothbrush in a silver cup. There's the miraculous body cream. Karen pulls open the little drawers, hoping that maybe Celeste tucked her things away so that she would feel at home. And yes, in the third drawer, there are her pills. Oh, thank you. It seems like an unusual place to put them, but maybe Celeste didn't want the summer housekeeper to stumble across them and be tempted. Karen thinks about chastising Celeste for pawing through her things. Everyone deserves a modicum of privacy, a secret or two. But mostly, Karen feels an overwhelming relief that is nearly as powerful as the pills themselves. She taps two oxy into her palm, fills the silver cup with water, and swallows. Greer. She checks her email to review the timetable that Siobhan the caterer sent her and, unfortunately, she sees a new email from Enid Collier, Greer's editor at Livingston and Greville, with the subject line, urgent. This makes Greer laugh. Enid is 77 years old. She has 11 grandchildren and one great-grandchild, and she still marks up Greer's manuscripts with a red pencil. Never once in the 22 years that Enid has been editing Greer's novels has she ever used the word urgent. Enid believes strongly in letting ideas marinate for days or weeks or months. There's nothing Enid despises more than a rush. Greer checks the email, even though the definition of urgent is transpiring right outside the window of Greer's sitting room. The rental people are setting up chairs, the band is doing a sound check, and 60 people are due to descend on Summerland for the rehearsal dinner, among them Featherlee Dale.
Dearest Greer, the email begins.
Enid composes all of her emails as formal letters.
I'm sure you will understand how it pains me to tell you this. Since I have long been a champion of your work, your very first champion, if you remember.
Yes, Greer does remember. She was out of her mind with boredom when she was pregnant with Thomas. Tag was at the office day and night back then, and so she'd started writing a murder mystery set in the 6th arrondissement of Paris, entitled Pré in the Saint-Germain-des-Prés. She had sent it off to Livingston and Greville, the publishing house that brought out the mysteries Greer most enjoyed herself, and, lo and behold, she received a letter of interest from an established editor named Enid Collins, who said she would like to publish the book, and might Greer be able to meet and discuss terms of payment and editorial changes? This had launched the Dolly Hardaway murder mystery series, the most successful of which, The Killer on Khao San Road, was made into a movie that somehow attained that elusive thing known as cult status.
But since we have been bought by Turnhout Publishing Group, my autonomy has been greatly diminished.
Is it really the fault of the corporate Goliath of Turnhout, fondly known as Turncoat, Greer wonders, or is Enid being pushed out because of her advanced age? Her driver's license will be the next thing taken, Greer supposes.
My editorial director, Mr. Charles O'Brien, also read your manuscript, and he has deemed it unacceptable. He has asked me to let you know you have a fortnight to rewrite it entirely. He suggests you use an alternate exotic locale, one you can describe with more colorful detail than what he calls the rather pale version of Santorini you present here. I'm sorry to be so blunt and to bear this dreadful news, my darling Greer, but a fortnight makes your new due date July 21st, and I felt it best to be direct in light of that looming deadline. With best wishes, Enid Collins.
Hell and damnation, Greer thinks. Her 21st manuscript has been rejected, then? Who is this Charles O'Brien, and what does he know? Charlie, old Chuck, an Irishman. Greer can't bring to mind an Irish writer she has ever admired. She has always despised Joyce, pretentious sod, writing in code and asking his readers to follow the twists and turns of his demented mind. She finds Wilde predictable, Swift histrionic, Beckett inscrutable, Stoker overrated, and Yeats dull. Her cell phone rings. It's Benji.
Roger has questions about the seating chart. Where are you?
In my sitting room,
witnessing the end of my career.
What had old Chuck O'Brien said about the book?
Pale.
He had called Greer's description of Santorini pale, and suggested Greer use a different exotic locale. It has been over 30 years since Greer set foot on Santorini. She chose it only because back in August, when Benji proposed to Celeste, he mentioned he would like to honeymoon there. Greer's own memories of the place were brilliant. She recalled stark limestone cliffs and a red beach, colored by iron deposits. Robust, bushy-haired Greek men selling freshly caught fish in woven baskets. She remembered the deep aquamarine of the Aegean Sea, whitewashed churches with cobalt-blue domes. The winding streets of Oya, the seafood restaurants where the water practically lapped onto one's feet, and everyone was offered the same wine, a lovely crisp white that was made on the east side of the island. Greer and Tag had chartered a catamaran, and Tag had sailed them around, while Greer sat under a canopy, wearing a floppy straw hat and Jackie O sunglasses. They had swum into the beaches from the boat and paid the cabana boys 2 drachmas for chaises and an umbrella. Greer had left the island with recipes for garlicky tzatziki, grilled chicken with lemon and fresh oregano, and of course her famous lamb souvlaki. She had been dismayed to find, upon researching Santorini 2018 via the internet, that Oya is now home to a Jimmy Choo boutique and that the donkey ride from the port up to Fira has been given a 1-star rating on TripAdvisor. Greer had adored the donkey ride. If she is very honest with herself, she will admit that the novel did feel a bit thin on plot, a bit slapdash, a bit phoned in, as it were. The key to a good whodunit is a murderer who is hiding in plain sight. Her character with a newly acquired stutter is, perhaps, underdeveloped. She remembers thinking when she handed the novel in, well, that wasn't so bad. She had delivered a 75,000-word manuscript on time, despite planning a wedding to rival Prince Harry's, and she hadn't pulled her hair out or been committed to an insane asylum. Things that seem too good to be true usually are. can she rewrite the novel in a fortnight? No one but the British, scratch that, no one but Enid Collins still uses the term fortnight. She isn't sure. She'll have to wait and see how the weekend goes. She clicks out of Enid, clicks out of email entirely. Thinking about the unpleasant reality of her work life has provided a distraction, at least, from the even more unpleasant reality of the present moment. Featherlee Dale will be arriving in less than an hour. Featherlee is the rare party guest who sees fit to show up exactly on time. She does this, Greer suspects, so that she can have some private moments with Tag. Tag is ready for every occasion half an hour early, and Greer is always half an hour late. It is a cunning and perceptive woman indeed who notes this habit and takes advantage of it, as Featherlee does. Greer changes into her party outfit, a sleek ivory silk jumpsuit by Halston, vintage, that looks like something Bianca Jagger might have worn to Studio 54. It's one of the most fabulous pieces Greer owns. She had the trousers temporarily shortened so that she might wear the jumpsuit barefoot in the sand, showing off her toenails, which have been painted pale blue. Her mother-of-the-groom dress for tomorrow is proper, which is to say matronly, and so tonight, Greer is going to emphasize her youthful, fun, carefree side. Tag might say she abandoned this side of herself in the 90s, and he might be partially correct, but she is reasserting it tonight. For the first time since primary school, she is going out in public with her hair down, all the way down, straight and loose on both sides of her face. She always wears her hair up or back, normally in a chignon, sometimes in a tight ballerina bun, occasionally braided for casual occasions. When she exercises, which is infrequently, she wears her hair in a ponytail. She never allows herself to wear it like this, like a hippie or something worse. But it's sexy. She looks younger. When she goes into the kitchen, Tag whistles, "You'd better get out of here before my wife sees you. She's quite formidable, with her hairpins and her diamonds." Greer grins at him. She doesn't do this enough, she realizes. Tag always gets the worst of her. Her laser focus, her inflexibility, her condescension, her acerbic tongue. She used to love that she could be herself in front of him, but now it feels like all he gets is the negative, unpleasant, unflattering aspects of Greer Garrison. The sweet, gentle, caring parts of her she saves for others. Her sons, certainly, but also virtual strangers, such as her fans, waiters at restaurants, and retail girls in shops. Greer is nicer to Tita at the Nantucket post office than she is to her own husband. She stands before him, raises her face, lowers her eyelids, purses her lips. "Darling," he says, "you look gorgeous." "No, I take that back. You look hot." He kisses her, and his hands cup her behind. The doorbell rings. That, Greer thinks, will be Featherlee. It isn't a question of if Tag has slept with Featherlee Dale. It's a question of how many times, how recently, and how far things went between them emotionally. Featherlee Dale is the much younger sister of the late Hamish Dale, who was Tag's closest friend at Oxford. To hear the stories, Featherlee used to come visit the boys at school when she was merely 8 years old, and would accompany them first to the pub and then to the nosebag, where they would reward Featherlee's patience with cheddar scones and lime posset. They also used her as a lure for young female students who thought it adorable that Hamish and Tag were minding a little sister. Hamish was killed 6 years earlier in a gruesome car crash on the M1. Greer and Tag and Thomas and Benji flew to London for the funeral and became reacquainted with Featherlee, who was then all grown up and living in Sloane Square, working in the fine carpet division of Sotheby's. As far as Greer knows, nothing happened between Tag and Featherlee at the reception following Hamish's funeral, although certainly cards were exchanged because after that,
Featherly Dale started to appear at nearly every social event the Winburys attended. She had shown up at a graduation party for Thomas's law school roommate, held at the Carlisle Hotel in New York. And that was when Greer grew suspicious. What were the chances that Featherly Dale would be at that party? Featherly claimed she had bumped into Thomas at a club downtown a few days earlier and that he had invited her. Ha, preposterous. The next time they had run into Featherly Dale had been when Tag and Greer took Thomas and Abby to Little Dick's Bay in Virgin Gorda over the Christmas holidays. Featherly had appeared on an enormous yacht belonging to some Saudi Arabian sheikh who was quite definitely gay. Somehow, Featherly had insinuated herself into Greer's life as well. When she left Sotheby's, she started her own business as a personal shopper who matched antiques with private homes in London. Featherly was too smart to come to Greer first. Instead, she started finding pieces for Greer's London neighbor Antonia. When Antonia mentioned that she had gotten a hard-to-find Kano School Japanese screen from Featherly Dale, Greer had said, "Oh, I know Featherly." And the next thing Greer knew, Featherly was calling her about this Morris chair and that Biedermeier walnut commode. Now Featherly is as much a part of Greer's life as she may or may not be of Tag's. There was no question about whether or not to invite her to the wedding. They had to. And there was no surprise in Featherly's response. Despite Greer's fierce wish that Featherly would decline, she had responded yes, for one. She would be attending alone.
"Will she be wearing the silver lace ring with the sapphires?" Greer wonders.
The ring is meant to be worn on the thumb. When Jessica Hicks, the jewelry designer, told Greer this, Greer had thought she'd misunderstood. Who wears a ring on her thumb? Only gypsies, so far as Greer knows. It sounds like a trend. But of course, no one adores a trend more than Featherly. She had moved to Sloane Square only because it was where a young Diana Spencer once lived. And what about Featherly's penchant for cold-shoulder dresses, which Donna Karan helped make popular in 1993? Greer can too easily picture Featherly waltzing right into Greer's home with the ring on her thumb. Greer hopes she can keep her composure while she admires the ring and asks Featherly where she got it. She will then watch Featherly Dale squirm. An hour into the rehearsal dinner, a bit of a misnomer, as the rehearsal was canceled due to Reverend Derby's travel delay, Greer is enjoying herself immensely. She is floating between the front lawn and the beach in her bare feet, with a glass of champagne in her hand that one of the adorable girls who work for the caterer is in charge of keeping filled. Greer asks the girl her name.
"Chloe," she says. "Chloe McAvoy."
"Don't be a stranger, Chloe," Greer says. A steady stream of champagne is the key to Greer staying relaxed. It's a glorious night. There's a light breeze off the water, and the sky looks like a blue ombre silk scarf as the sun descends, setting the Nantucket skyline aglow. The band is playing songs by James Taylor, Jimmy Buffett, the Beach Boys. Greer tries to manage her time among all of the guests arriving and the major players, Benji, Celeste, the wedding party, and Mr. and Mrs. Otis. Mrs. Otis, Karen, looks lovely in an embroidered kimono. She leans on her cane for a few minutes, talking with Tag's interminably boring colleague from work, and then, just as Greer feels she must swoop in and save the poor woman, with so little time left, Karen has none to waste on Peter Walls, Bruce leads Karen over to a chair at the edge of the action. She will sit and receive visitors like a queen, as she should. Benji is talking with Shooter and the four Alexanders from Hobart. Alex K, Alex B, Alex W, and Xander. Greer is fond of Benji's Hobart friends. All of them have spent long weekends here at Summerland. But no one has captured Greer's heart quite as much as Shooter. Shooter Uxley is the son of a Palm Beach real estate scion and his mistress. Shooter's mother got pregnant with the sole intention of eliciting a marriage proposal, but it never came. The father had 5 other children by 2 wives, and he was senile enough to let one of his older sons oversee his will, which cut Shooter and his mother out entirely. Shooter had somehow managed to produce the tuition for his last year at St. George's, but after graduation he had been forced to find a job. That he has turned himself into such a success is a testament to his intelligence, his charm, and his perseverance. Greer sips her champagne and wanders to the raw bar, where Tag is sucking down oyster after oyster, dripping shellfish liquor onto his bespoke pink shirt, tailored for him at Henry Poole. Despite how much Tag loves New York, he trusts only Savile Row tailors, and yet he seems to think nothing of defiling said shirts in the name of a good bivalve. He would stay here all night if Greer let him.
"You should take a plate of those over to the Otises," Greer says. "Karen is sitting and Bruce is stationed at her side like the Swiss Guard."
"Do they eat oysters, do you think?" Tag asks.
Good question. Celeste confided that Mrs. Otis is excited about having lobster. There had been some confusion with the term clambake, because she, Karen Otis, hasn't eaten lobster since her honeymoon more than 30 years earlier. Greer tried to hide her shock. At the end of every summer on this island, it was all Greer could do not to feel weary of lobster, after having lobster rolls at Crewe, the lobster spaghetti from the boarding house, lobster fritters and tartlets and beignets and avocado toast with lobster at every cocktail party she attends. But, of course, Karen Otis lives a vastly different life. Greer informed Siobhan Crispin, the caterer, that the mother of the bride was to be offered as much lobster as she wanted, and that all uneaten lobsters should be cracked and the meat stashed in a bag in the fridge of the main house in case Mrs. Otis craved a midnight snack.
"Just offer, please," Greer says to Tag. "Take some of the shrimp with cocktail sauce and lemons. They'll like that."
"Good idea," Tag says.
He leans over to kiss her.
"You're very thoughtful."
"And hot," she reminds him.
"Hottest woman here," Tag says. "Not that I've noticed another soul."
"Have you seen Featherly?" Greer asks.
This will not seem like a loaded question, because in all this time, Greer has never confronted Tag with her suspicions.
"I caught a glimpse," Tag says. "She looks god-awful."
"Does she?"
Greer says, although she knows the answer is yes. Greer sought Featherly out immediately after dealing with the last-minute party logistics, and although it's ungracious, Greer will say that the 20 pounds, at least, that Featherly has gained, and Featherly's bad haircut and her even worse dye job and her reddened nose are the best things about this wedding weekend so far. Greer had checked both of Featherly's hands. She was not wearing the ring. Greer had found herself almost deflated by this. She had been ready for a confrontation. Instead, Greer had no choice but to be civil.
"Featherly Dale, you're a sight for sore eyes."
The corners of Featherly's mouth had pulled down unattractively.
"Thank you for having me," she'd said.
She had then proceeded to detail the horror of her travel. No money for a first-class ticket, so she was squished in coach. The flight from New York to Nantucket was overbooked. Everyone was obnoxious. There was no decent food at the airport. She'd had a Nathan's hot dog, and the thing was as shriveled as a mummy's pecker. "She finds Nantucket damp. Just look at her hair. The place she booked is an inn, not a hotel. So there's no room service, no fitness center, no spa. And the pillowcases are decorated with tulle flowers. They're honestly the most hideous thing she's ever seen. How's she supposed to lay her head on something like that, she has no idea. But the inn was the only place available because she'd waited until the last minute. She wasn't going to come at all because she was so low on funds, but then she hoped the trip would help snap her out of her funk."
"Funk?"
Greer asked, wondering if this litany was ever going to end.
"My business went belly up," Featherly said. "And I've been through a devastating breakup."
"Aha," Greer thinks. "So it's over with Tag?"
"Which is why I have this bad dye job and I look like an absolute hippo,"
It's been all vodka and fish and chips and takeout vindaloo for me. I'm 45 years old, I'm not married, I have no children, I have no job, I'm under investigation.
A devastating breakup? Greer said, backing up to the only one of Featherly's complaints that she cared about.